This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Emily Burke. Tonight, a furor in the scientific community about whether there's something special and undiscovered in fresh air that prevents COVID-19 virus transmission. Also, the plan to breathe life back into Australia's universities by making a former Darwin Detention Centre a portal for international students.
We've got a fantastic facility right here in the top end. They can take 1,500 students at a time. We could function as an entry point and an access point for international students coming to all parts of Australia.
And after two decades on the ground, US and Australian forces withdrawing from Afghanistan. But the pain and suffering grinds on for families of those lost.
Oh, look, it's still raw. It still hurts. Look, we're leading up to Anzac Day next weekend. In my opinion, it's never going to be easy. And all the other families that we associate with feel the same way.
A new assessment of the COVID pandemic has found consistent and overwhelming evidence that the virus is predominantly transmitted through the air. New analysis by six international experts has been published in The Lancet today and points to 10 scientific reasons why coronavirus is airborne. It calls on the World Health Organization and other public health agencies to accept the scientific evidence so that more is done to stop transmission of the virus. At the same time, one of Australia's most senior infection control experts is facing a storm of criticism after sharing a series of controversial tweets about the role of fresh air in the prevention of COVID. Professor Peter Collignon is an infectious diseases physician from the ANU Medical School and a member of the Infection Control Expert Group, which advises the government. He's advancing the so-called open air factor, the idea that disinfecting powers of fresh outdoor air can be preserved indoors if ventilation rates are kept high enough. Scientific and medical experts here and overseas say the theories are wrong and misrepresent the purpose of ventilation. Professor Collignon insists it's worth looking at, saying there are factors in the air that need further scientific exploration and that we ignore the historical medical observations of the past at our peril. My interview with him in just a moment, but first, a quick science lesson from two of the world's leading atmospheric scientists. Aerosol physician Professor Lydia Morovska is from Queensland University of Technology.
Bringing outdoor air inside, which means ventilation, has the purpose of removing any pathogens generated inside, outside, to clean the indoor air.
Not to kill the COVID-infected particles?
Not to kill the COVID-infected particles, not at all.
And is that only because the UV does not travel with the outdoor air inside? The fresh air factor does not travel inside.
Well, the fresh air factor doesn't travel inside, and outdoor air doesn't have any magical means for killing the virus or other magical means.
Professor Lydia Morovska there. Well, Professor Jose Luis Jimenez is from the University of Colorado, and he's among a team behind today's research published in The Lancet.
Does fresh air have germicidal properties?
This is news to me. We know that ultraviolet light has germicidal properties. So the light from the sun has germicidal properties. If there is some light outdoors, that will have germicidal properties.
Do you think there is any value in sharing the open air factor theory in the context of COVID prevention and infection control?
No, I mean, I just cannot see. I mean, it's some very old research, very few papers, and it hasn't really been pursued, and it doesn't seem relevant in any way to COVID transmission. I am extremely concerned about him and the information he has been sharing. And not just this example, but it has been for months, he has been basically describing aerosols and droplets in ways that are completely inconsistent with current science and completely inconsistent with physics. So this is a huge worldwide problem that they refuse to listen to modern science. We are publishing a paper in The Lancet, again, where we summarize all the evidence that this is predominantly an airborne virus. And there is basically zero evidence that this virus is transmitted through either droplets or surfaces. But yet, all the major advisory bodies like WHO tell us that this is a virus that's transmitted through these droplets and these surfaces. And this is just absurd. And is making controlling the pandemic a lot more difficult.
The president of the West Australian branch of the Australian Medical Association is Andrew Miller.
But what doctors are concerned about is that this reveals a pattern of really quite bizarre thinking that at the front line is having an effect on lack of protection for workers and leading, for example, to a medical registrar in Queensland being infected in her workplace. I think it's in the public interest that someone who is so influential on Australian government policy is pulled up when they advance a theory that has no basis in modern science. It is behoving upon those of us who are in leadership positions in this to only be discussing reasonable science and not crackpot theories.
For his response, I spoke to Peter Collignon.
But I shared the articles because I thought they were important for people to look at.
Why?
The reason that I think it's important is that we need everything we should do to decrease the risk of COVID or other infections. And we ignore, I think, observations and research done even 100 years ago at our peril. I mean, what was really obvious from research done there, that both for tuberculosis and influenza, you decreased your risk markedly of getting those diseases if you had, you know, were outside in fresh air, and even if you allowed a lot of fresh air to come into buildings, both in hospitals and elsewhere. And I might say that's exactly what we're seeing with COVID. There is very little transmission in when you're outside. We don't quite understand all the reasons for that. And also, if you actually do have some adequate ventilation in buildings with fresh air coming in, that also decreases your risk. No, I don't think anybody would dispute that. The mechanism may be arguable, and whether there's factors we haven't found yet, that's really important, because if there are factors in the air that we can somehow harness to make indoors safer, well and good. But we ignore this, in my belief, at our peril.
Aerosol scientists, atmospheric scientists say that these theories, the open air factor theories, have been discredited. They're from the 1960s. Why are you reviving them? Because it's in fact humidity, it is ultraviolet light, it is wind, it is the movement of outdoor air that helps dilute infection. You don't transport ultraviolet light indoors with fresh air.
Well, there are many other factors that are important too, humidity being one. It's one of the reasons being indoors is probably an increased risk. If you're in really dry, low humidity environments, you seem to be more susceptible to viruses. So it doesn't mean those factors are not factors as well, but I don't think anybody's disproved this open air theory. It's just there are other explanations that may also account for some of what you find. But I think it's very simplistic to say that this is all to do just with aerosols and there's not other factors. So I just think what is really important is that we look at all the things that are observations that work. And patently with COVID, if you're outside and you increase ventilation and have more outside air coming in, you decrease the risk. It doesn't make the risk zero, but it decreases it. We need more science, more literature, more experiments, research to work out, well, what are these factors and can we harness them better to our advantage?
There's quite a bit of criticism over the content that you've shared and whether it is appropriate for someone of your standing and your position to be sharing that kind of content during a pandemic.
Well, I actually find those accusations are really closed-minded people who could possibly say that. These are observations that nobody can dispute. You may argue what the mechanism is, but if we don't actually obviously accept that being outside is much safer than being indoors, I give up. I mean, where are these people coming from? Which planet are they on? The observations in Australia and elsewhere, if you're outside, you are much, much safer than if you're inside. If you have more fresh air, it seems to protect you as well. And these arguments that it's nothing to do with, you know, anything other than ultraviolet light. The reality is even at night when there's no ultraviolet light, you have more protection if you're outside than you're inside. If you take that air and do experiments with it, it gives you some protection, but quickly loses its protection. So there are things we do not understand. But to ignore the reality that fresh air and outside air is much, much safer than being inside, I think that is just closed-mindedness.
Professor Peter Collignon, infectious diseases physician from the ANU Medical School and a member of the Infection Control Expert Group. The Federal Health Department has declined to comment on Professor Collignon's remarks. The latest advice from the expert group states that COVID is mainly transmitted by close personal contact or via contaminated surfaces. It says COVID is less likely transmitted via small respiratory particles, that is aerosols, except during specific procedures or behaviours. Well, the Chief Medical Officer Paul Kelly this afternoon has made an impassioned plea for people, particularly in groups at high risk of getting or dying of COVID, to get vaccinated, conceding that there has been some hesitancy amongst those eligible to be vaccinated. He's urging people to weigh up the risks of getting COVID with the extremely small risk of a blood clot linked to the AstraZeneca vaccine.
We will, at some point in the future, we don't know when, but we will have cases here in Australia, the chances of being infected will increase. So being vaccinated is a protection not only for yourself, but also for the people you care for. If you're working, for example, in an aged care home or in a hospital, your family and the wider community.
He's also referenced a study that hasn't yet been peer-reviewed looking at the risk of blood clots caused by getting the virus itself.
Clotting is a feature of COVID. It also happens to be a feature very rarely of this AstraZeneca vaccine, but the benefit absolutely, and particularly for those over the age of 50, outweighs significantly the risk of that particular event.
Independent experts warn, though, that there are problems with the study's methodology and say it compares separate types of clotting syndromes. The chief medical officer is also urging people not to speculate or jump to conclusions after a 48-year-old woman died of blood clotting after receiving the AstraZeneca vaccine. The Therapeutic Goods Administration has convened a special expert group to consider the case. Well, ahead of the travel bubble with New Zealand starting next week, the Prime Minister has outlined what a limited return to international travel might look like. Australians could be allowed to travel overseas for essential reasons and quarantine at home upon return. But that all depends on the speed and success of the vaccine rollout. And with revelations that a third dose of the imported Pfizer vaccine is likely to be needed for adequate protection against the virus, there are renewed calls for Australia to invest in the technology to produce the mRNA vaccine here. Caroline Winter reports from Parliament House.
After a year of international border closures, thousands of Australians are still stranded overseas and many are keen to go abroad. Now there's been a glimmer of hope from the Prime Minister on how Australia can reconnect with the rest of the world.
What I'd like to see happen next is ensuring that we can know when an Australian who's vaccinated here with their two doses is able to travel overseas and return without having to go through hotel quarantine.
Scott Morrison loosely outlined a return to overseas travel on Nine Radio and at a community forum in Perth. He suggested initially people could travel for business, medical reasons and important events like funerals, and they could quarantine at home on their return. Just how that would work isn't clear. That's for the federal government's medical panel to work out. But it came with a warning.
Vaccinations are not a silver bullet. We've never said they are. If we were to lift the borders and people were to come, then you would see those cases increase. And Australians would have to become used to dealing with 1,000 cases a week or more.
But any easing of restrictions will likely rely on an accelerated vaccination rollout, which has been beset by delays. And with the recent shift from the homemade AstraZeneca vaccine to the imported Pfizer vaccine as the preferred option for under 50s, a timeline for all Australians to get their first dose is in turmoil.
We were told 4 million Australians would be vaccinated by March. That didn't happen. We were told Australia was at the front of the queue. We're at the back of the queue.
Federal Opposition Leader Anthony Albanese says the government has let down Australians here and overseas. But the plan for home quarantine could open the door for those stranded to make it back.
Scott Morrison said that Australians would be home by Christmas. That's Christmas 2020. There are more than 40,000 Australians still stranded overseas.
Any plan will need the backing of the states and territories. New South Wales and Victoria say it's something to consider, but not until the majority of the population has been vaccinated. And that's an even bigger ask now, with Pfizer saying it's likely a third dose of the vaccine will be needed on top of the current two, plus an annual booster shot.
we have no small, medium or large scale mRNA manufacturing capacity at all. And it's really the critical factor impeding us.
Archer Fox is an mRNA researcher at the University of Western Australia. She says with the global supply of Pfizer under pressure, there's an urgent need to produce it locally.
Ideally, would have been the best time would have been mid last year, but it is not too late. The sooner we get into the game, the sooner we can start sort of developing our own homegrown IP around this technology as well.
Local production would also give researchers the flexibility to change the vaccine to match variants in the virus.
We always seem to be one step behind this virus, but the ability to make our own vaccines tailor-made to the variants that are a problem to us, you know, that would be a really great factor in a solution for Australia.
National Cabinet will meet on Monday to discuss how to get Australia's troubled vaccine rollout back on track.
Caroline Winter with that report, and you're listening to PM on radio, on the ABC Listen app and via podcast. I'm Emily Burke. Thanks for your company. Ahead, the big banks at odds over just how much house prices will rise this year and what to do about it. The federal government has been presented with a plan for reviving the struggling university sector by allowing international students to restart returning to Australia. Northern Territory Liberal Senator Sam McMahon has today asked her federal colleagues to make a former Darwin Immigration Detention Centre a quarantining portal for foreign students. But even if the plan is accepted, it may only replace a fraction of what the universities say they need. Jane Barden has the story.
Despite having to cut hundreds of jobs and courses over the last 2 years, Charles Darwin University is pushing ahead with building a new campus in the city centre because the $250 million project is mostly being funded with a federal government grant.
This is probably the best hole that Darwin has ever seen. And growing out of the best hole will be the best city campus in Australia.
But as the delayed vaccine rollout looks like further delaying Australia's international borders from reopening, the Vice Chancellor, Professor Scott Bowman, doesn't know when he's going to be able to fill it with students.
Really, not to have those international students is very tough for us. And we will work with governments in the territory and the federal government to talk to them about solutions around that. I would say, though, that Charles Darwin University is not exposed to the international market as much as some universities. At our peak, we've had around 16% international students. Some universities are up well over 50%, and they are in a world of pain.
The university has been the only one in the country allowed to bring in foreign students. 63 arrived from Singapore in November. Other proposals by Victorian, South Australian and ACT universities have faltered, while the federal government remains under pressure to use limited quarantine places for stranded Australians. But today, Liberal Senator Sam McMahon has asked her government colleagues to make a former immigration detention centre at Bladen Point outside Darwin a national portal for foreign student arrivals.
We've got a fantastic facility. They can take 1,500 students at a time, so we can safely have 1,500 international students coming into Darwin every 2 weeks.
And have you asked your federal colleagues if we can do that?
I have put that proposal to my federal colleagues and that it's being considered at the moment. It will obviously need the approval of the Northern Territory government.
And we've had some of the defence and other returning personnel using that facility up to now. Where will they go if the students go into Bladen?
My understanding is there is plenty of capacity at Bladen, and these different people can be quarantined in different areas and separated. We could function as an entry point and an access point for international students coming to all parts of Australia.
Peter Hurley from Victoria University's Mitchell Institute says even if the plan is accepted, it would only ease the pressure on universities slightly.
There's 150,000 currently international student visa holders outside of the country. That 1,500 places, you have to quarantine for 2 weeks. I mean, it's going to take a very, very, very long time just to process the backlog of the 150,000 people who are overseas. And that's before you get to being able to get new students into the country.
Some of the universities have been reasonably successful at getting the international students to keep signing up online. But what situation are they really facing financially?
There's about $2.5 billion worth of international student revenue attached to people's study online. And this has gone up from about $9 million. But what you've got to do is consider that in terms of the kind of greater falls that are occurring. International student revenue has already fallen by about $9 billion. You're looking at another, say, $10 billion this year on top of that $9 billion. So it's just not enough.
The Federal Health Department answered PM's query about whether it will accept Senator McMahon's plan by saying bringing Australians home remains its priority and international students will return when conditions allow. The Northern Territory government says it's open to hearing about the proposal, provided the federal government is happy to pay for it.
Jane Barden reporting. There's been record growth in house prices lately, but there's now just a hint that some heat may be coming out of the market. It follows lengthy testimony from bosses of the big four banks this week to a parliamentary economics committee. While some banks still see double-digit house prices growth this year, not everyone agrees that the market remains red hot. And even if prices do continue to climb higher, analysts say they expect the regulators may move to cool prices as early as the second half of this year. Here's business reporter David Taylor.
ANZ boss Shane Elliott says house prices could rise by 17% this year. But he's also told the House of Representatives Economics Committee Australians are extending themselves to grab their slice of the Australian dream. And that has limits. He's speaking here with committee chair Tim Wilson.
Oh, well, at some point that can only get stretched so far. I mean, at the moment that has been enabled because at the same time interest rates have fallen. And that has enabled that to stretch.
The NAB's chief executive, Ross McEwen, however, worries unless something's done to boost housing supply, price rises will become steeper.
I strongly support the first home buyer incentives, but we know supply is restricted and the states need to streamline approval processes for land development and residential construction.
Hear, hear.
Without decisive moves to increase housing supply, demand side incentives will inevitably act to push up house prices further and faster.
The Commonwealth Bank is Australia's largest provider of home loans. Chief Executive Matt Comyn appeared before the committee yesterday. He's trying to soothe the nerves of buyers who fear they've missed out, saying he expects the market to actually cool a little from here.
We expect house prices will continue to grow during the course of this calendar year and next, but not at the rate that we've seen in February and March, which was quite a rapid uptick.
Adelaide Timbrell's tasked by the ANZ to analyse the property market and what may influence it. She doesn't see the current strong acceleration in property prices continuing because it's being driven by first home buyers and owner occupiers, not investors, as it was between 2013 and 2017.
We do think that pricing gains will slow, but we don't think that they will stop.
And she says, in any case, if the red-hot property market doesn't cool soon, she's confident the Council of Financial Regulators, which includes the Reserve Bank and APRA, will ask the banks to make borrowing harder to do.
One thing that we could see that will slow down the trajectory of housing prices will be macroprudential regulations, which we think will happen in the second half of the year. I think the Reserve Bank has spoken a couple of times on their concerns over housing lending trends. We do know that low deposit and high debt-to-income loans are on the rise, and that's something that will probably trigger some of those regulatory actions.
APRA recently told the business gathering it'll implement those actions when its risk alarm bells begin ringing, and it'll do what it did between 2015 and 2017, asking the banks to create bigger loan buffers for customers. But as committee chair Tim Wilson points out to ANZ boss Shane Elliott, the problem with this regulatory response is that it actually hurts first home buyers and owner occupiers in favour of investors.
You're quite right that unintentionally, I think, that tends to have more impact on people who are more high indebted, and they typically tend to be first home buyers. So yes, are there ways to design macroprudential interventions that don't have that impact? I imagine there are.
At this point, debt distress appears not to be an issue. The banks are now reporting 30-day arrears, under 2% of all issued loans.
David Taylor. There was a time when the end of war and the homecoming of troops was a cause for mass celebrations in the streets. Not so for Australia's longest military campaign, the war in Afghanistan. The announcement that Australia will join the US in pulling out of the country later this year has been a trigger for painful memories and worries about what may be in store for the troubled nation. Nick Grimm reports.
On the streets of the Afghan capital Kabul, the looming departure of foreign troops from their soil is no cause for celebrations for locals like this. It's a worrying situation, this man says. People believe that if they leave the country, there will be a civil war. Another Afghan has this.
Every day there is a bomb blast here and we're tired of it. The Taliban have always said, we fight because the foreign troops are in Afghanistan. But now there are no more excuses left. We want the Taliban to come and make peace.
The Taliban might not have come as yet, but the US Secretary of State has, making an unannounced visit to the country to outline plans for the withdrawal of American troops.
I know this is a moment for many of mixed emotions.
Anthony Blinken also paying tribute to those whose blood and sweat helped fight the two-decade-long war.
These service members risked their lives, thousands gave their lives. And we've succeeded in achieving the objective we set out to achieve because of their service, because of their sacrifice.
And that sacrifice includes Australian lives.
The loss is great. The sacrifice, immense.
The Prime Minister not alone in shedding a tear yesterday for the 41 servicemen who died serving in Afghanistan. But retired Australian Army Captain Jason Skains, who was also there, believes the mourning must include those who've taken their own lives in the years since.
You know, since that conflict has started, it has caused a lot of grief for a lot of troops returning and trying to adjust to normalities here in Australia and civilian life. And, you know, the suicide rate, I think, is totally unacceptable.
The former intelligence officer wants a Royal Commission established into those and other veteran suicides, and he's backed by Ray Palmer, whose son Scott died in a Black Hawk helicopter crash in Afghanistan in 2010. But he's been dismayed to see many of his son's comrades also lose their lives.
So a lot of Scott's close friends have already committed suicide, so they're no longer here. And some of the others have managed to get help by themselves, if you know what I mean. They went out and seeked help for themselves when they weren't getting it from the Defence Force. Excuse me. I just feel really annoyed that, especially after you look at what happened after Vietnam and the consequences of that and how many guys took their lives over that, there was nothing ever taken up for looking at future conflicts, you know what I'm saying? And I don't know why not. Why didn't they rethink back on Vietnam, saying, all right, well, how can we do this better? How can we address this better? How can we look at what the consequences of sending our guys to Iraq or Afghanistan and coming home and finding they have got mental issues? How can we put things in place to ensure that we give them all the assistance they need?
For Ray Palmer, the end of the war in Afghanistan is a welcome development, even if it does stir up the pain of his son's loss.
Oh, look, it's still raw. It still hurts. Like, we're leading up to Anzac Day next weekend. So a lot of things keep coming forward, you know what I mean? It's never, I don't think, in my opinion, it's never going to be easy. And all the other families that we associate with feel the same way. Because just a big chunk taken out of your life, you know, it's part of growing up, and you've enjoyed all those times with someone that you really were proud of, and it's gone. You know what I mean? It's just not there anymore. So it's pretty hard.
That story by Nick Grimm and Jane Barden. And if that story has raised issues for you or anyone you know, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or the Veterans Support Line Open Arms on 1800 011 046. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is David Cody. Technical production by Scott Johnson and Alan Arthur. Research by Rima Cheer. I'm Emily Burke. Thanks for your company. The PM team will be back with Linda Mottram on Monday night.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. Joe Biden made it very clear from the outset that handling the pandemic in America was number one on his to-do list. So nearly 3 months into his term as president, how's he doing?
Today on The Signal, after some early wins against the virus, America's luck seems to have turned, with COVID transmission on the rise again. So what's gone wrong, and can Biden turn it around before it becomes a fourth wave? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.